TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Loss of West Antarctic Glaciers. An interview with Professor Chris Rapley. When NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, announced at a press conference on May 12, 2014, that the loss of the West Antarctic glaciers in the Amundsen Sea embayment appears unstoppable, I asked Professor Chris Rapley for his comments. As former director of the British Antarctic Survey, it had been his job and expertise to know all aspects of Antarctic research. The interview I did with him in 2005, when he was still directing the BAS, gave such an intriguing view of Antarctica that it was reprinted in The Ecologist magazine. Born and educated in Britain, Rapley became an international scientist. 40 years ago, he began a 6-year term with NASA's Solar Maximum mission. Then he lectured at the Department of Space and Climate Physics of University College London from 1981 to 87. He became executive director of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program at the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in Stockholm in 1994. The IGBP helps identify and assess risks posed to society and ecosystems by climate change. After almost 10 years as director of the British Antarctic Survey, Professor Chris Rapley accepted the job as director of the Science Museum in London. He had become more and more engaged with the question how to communicate the scientific facts of climate change and counteract the overwhelming financial power of the climate change deniers. They are preventing urgently needed action in face of a clear and present danger. Rapley moved back to University College London as professor of climate science and has spent the last couple of years working with other scientists on the psychology of climate dismissal, the communication of climate science, and the interaction of climate science and policy. I spoke to Professor Rapley by phone on May 23, 2014, to get his comments on the news that the West Antarctic, Pine Island, Thwaites, Haines, Pope, Smith, and Kohler glaciers appear to be in an irreversible state of decline, with nothing to stop the glaciers in this area from melting into the sea. These glaciers contain enough ice to raise global sea level by 4 feet. NASA and UC Irvine Professor Eric Vigneault and his team had presented 40 years of data, supported by more recent satellite observations. In the 2 TUC radio programs prior to this one, Vigneault explained in detail why this melting is unstoppable. Here's Professor Chris Rapley with his comments. When I listened to the May 12 press conference by NASA about the disintegration of all 6 glaciers in the West Antarctic, I thought of you and wondered what your response might be and those of your colleagues.
I guess I was slightly saddened and worried. I mean, this is something that we had thought might happen. We knew that it could happen, but I guess we all hope that it wouldn't happen because we've reached the point now where the ocean warming, the warm water that's been pushed up over the continental shelf has removed those ice shelves, the floating parts of the ice sheet, you know, where the ice sheet has extruded off onto the ocean. And those ice shelves were pinned in shallow waters and on little reefs and so on. So they were holding back the flow of these glaciers. And the situation now, where are we, 10 years on or something, has reached the point where those floating ice shelves have gone. And as we knew, once that happened, because the ice in this area is sitting on on rock that is well below sea level, that slopes away from the coast and goes deep, deep down below sea level, as much as a couple of kilometers. We knew that once this happened, once the cork, if you like, was pulled out of the bottle, then these glaciers would just accelerate and continue to accelerate until they drained really quite a large area, quite a large volume of the West Antarctic ice sheet. So we're committed now, probably, unless something completely unforeseen happens, and it seems that seems very unlikely, we're committed now to a sea level rise of probably a meter to a meter and a half just from this area, a global sea level rise of a meter, maybe 1.2 meters. And a global sea level rise of 1.2 meters will be very, very, very costly indeed for coastal cities and coastal areas to protect themselves against. And it's getting to the level where if you add in other contributions, which there will be, you know, more thermal expansion of the ocean, more melting of small glaciers, you know, more melting of Greenland, more melting of other parts of the Antarctic, it means that we'll almost certainly within 100 or 200, maybe 300 years, have to abandon, let's say, large parts of London, you know, New York, Amsterdam, Rotterdam, you know, all the big coastal cities and all the places where we have infrastructure like, you know, petroleum processing plants, harbors, nuclear power stations, all of these things. So this is no small issue. And even though you can say, well, it's a couple of hundred years away, many people have leases on their buildings that are longer than that. So their buildings will be worthless on timescales less than the duration of their current leases.
When we spoke in 2005, you were still heading the British Antarctic Survey then. You were saying that Antarctica was an awakening giant. Would you say that the tipping point has been reached?
Well, for this area, certainly. And I think it's, you know, thinking back, there was quite a lot of media coverage of my comment, you know, that previously I'd kind of considered Antarctica the slumbering giant, but there were signs that it was becoming the awakening giant. And to some extent, I've been, if not ridiculed, I've been criticized by those who still don't want to accept that climate change is a real and present threat. Being criticized as having been alarmist, you know, one of these crazy alarmists. So, but it doesn't really give me much pleasure in saying, well, you know, I told you so, you know, where do we stand now? And after all, what's really galling is that I think I said in that previous interview that there was a guy called Mercer in 1978 who predicted all of this. You know, he predicted that there would be a sequential collapse of floating ice shelves on the down the Antarctic Peninsula, which indeed we saw happen, you know, a decade or so ago. And then he said the next thing to start looking for would be the collapse of these ice shelves in the Amundsen Sea embayment, and then the acceleration of those glaciers draining the that West Antarctic area. And so all of this was understood. You know, people knew that this was going to happen if we didn't stop changing the energy balance of the planet by changing the chemistry of the atmosphere, by, you know, releasing all of the carbon dioxide into it. And of course, you know, the release of the carbon dioxide was a sort of unwitting byproduct of generating energy. But the point was that this was all known. So it's rather tragic, isn't it, that now, you know, that part is unstoppable. But it's kind of a warning. It says, well, you know, there are other things that we know will happen if we don't take action, and we should take action. And I guess if I might comment, you know, one of the things that really puzzles me, it deeply puzzles me, is that particularly in the United States, but also in Australia and to a degree, a growing degree in the UK, this has become a politically partisan issue. That is, you know, one, if you are, you know, have favor right-wing politics, you don't believe in this. And if you favor left-wing politics, you do. But I'm deeply puzzled that the right-wing, after all, surely they're interested in the interests of the U.S. citizen and the U.S. nation. And it was President Nixon, as far as I remember, who established the Environmental Protection Agency. And it's the U.S. military who are taking climate change deeply seriously because they see it as a kind of fourth amplifier of all of the other stresses in the world, food stresses, supply chain stresses, water stresses, unstable nations. And so, you know, here we are, you know, 10 years on, we didn't take any notice of the warnings, and now we're paying that price. But it deeply puzzles me that the US right can't admit that this is true. It just seems very, very odd to me.
You know, what I also find puzzling is that here is Mercer, who knew this to be true in the 60s and 70s. And all he had to go by, as far as I can tell, is some radar observations of the topography of the Amundsen Sea embayment. Now we have so many satellite and additional radar observations that have given us a much clearer picture. And there's really no doubt about, you know, velocity and thickness and et cetera and GPS measurements. Why hasn't that become more convincing?
All of the latest data, you know, the data from the European satellites, ERS-1, ERS-2, Envisat, last week, there's been a paper published from the latest European Space Agency's ICE mission, Cryosat, which shows that the rate of delivery of water to the ocean from West Antarctica, well, actually from Antarctica as a whole, because it's dominated by this input, has doubled between 2005 to 2010 and 2010 to 2013. So it's now 160 billion tons of ice a year. We know that there's one glacier, that the surface is deflating by 9 meters per year. We know that this is raising sea level, or it's contributing to sea level rise, about 20% of the total sea level rise that we're seeing. And so all of this new technology has given us a really crystal sharp picture of what's going on. But we knew enough. We knew in the 1960s and 1970s the basic physics, the basic laws of hydrostatic. Archimedes could have looked at what we knew in the 1960s. Archimedes, the Greek, from 2,000 years ago, and he could have said, boy, that looks bad, because the ocean pressure will lift the ice up and cause it to accelerate. So I think what is really weird is that we knew enough. We knew enough that we should take action in the 1970s. We certainly knew enough 10 years ago that we should take action. And we've got even crisper data now. You know, what do people need? You know, they need to be completely flooded? It'll be too late. So it seems to me that there's a real issue here between what politicians and people need to make the move. What do they need? You know, thousands of people, millions of people disadvantaged? Or do they just need the evidence? The scientific method is different from opinion, and it's different from wishful thinking. You know, I know a lot of politicians in the UK, and we sort of describe their attitude to this as the kind of Tinkerbell thing, you know, the famous Peter Pan thing, where I think Tinkerbell says to Peter Pan, you know, if you wish hard enough, Peter, it will come true. Well, maybe in fairy stories, but not in the real world. In the real world, you know, physics, chemistry, gravity, hydrostatics, they happen. They perform according to laws of nature, basic fundamental laws of nature. And so however much people might wish that they wouldn't, they will. And so what we've seen is that narrative, that story unfold, and unfortunately it will continue to unfold. And in this particular case, there's nothing we can do about it. We can't stop it now. But there are other things that are lurking out there where if we took action now, we could prevent them. But, you know, what will it take for people to take notice? I don't know. It's very frustrating.
What are the things that are lurking?
One of the things that kind of worries me, or if you like, when I think of my grandchildren, it kind of scares me, is that we know that in the permafrost, you know, in Siberia, in northern Canada, and so on, huge amounts of methane are currently locked up in that frozen soil. And in addition, in the shallow seas to the north of Russia in particular, there are some materials called plathrates. And this is a sort of frozen form of methane just sitting on the seabed. And we know that if the temperature of the ocean warms, the Arctic Ocean warms down there, you know, at that depth, a degree or so, then these clathrates go unstable and they start to bubble up as methane. And there's some indication that this is beginning to happen. Some Russian research vessels, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, were doing some research in the Arctic Ocean in these shallow seas, and they found what they called chimneys of bubbles. So imagine just a sort of tight little group of bubbles coming up. They were kind of 10, you know, meters to 10 meters across. And then this methane is just bubbling out into the atmosphere. It's unstoppable. But then when they went up a couple of years later, they found that these same chimneys of bubbles were there, but now they were a kilometer across. So leaking substantial amounts of methane into the atmosphere. So from the shallow ocean, and of course it's coming out of the permafrost. Now methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So it may be that there's a serious tipping point. It may be. You know, we don't really know, but there are some unwelcome signs that we're seeing things happen that suggest that this idea that this vast amount of methane could be released could happen. Then we're in deep trouble, because that would be sufficient to accelerate the climate disruption that caused it in the first place. So it acts as a big amplifier. Now, the one slightly comforting or consoling thing is that when the Earth has been this warm in previous interglacials, these periods between the 100,000-year ice ages, we don't seem to have had a runaway greenhouse effect. You know, somehow something seems to have kicked in and stabilized things, but we don't know what it is. We do know that sea level was 5 meters higher the last time we were in an interglacial that was a couple of degrees warmer than the world is now. So we do know that big things can happen. So anyway, the point is this, that lurking out there is that particular phenomenon. And what we see is already disquieting. So maybe if you interview me in 10 years' time, I don't know, you know, maybe wrong, maybe right, we'll see how it turns out. We might be going, oh my God, we got all of this methane running out uncontrollably now, and that is really bad news. So it's all to do with risk management. You know, there are people out there who say, well, why don't we sit back and see? Okay, well, that's one way of dealing with it. But if when we discover that things are as bad as they might be, they are unstoppable, then we might wish that we'd been a little bit wiser and a little bit more prudent.
Now, you have since returned to the University College in London as climate science Professor
of climate science. Yes,
yes.
But in between, I was director of the Science Museum in London for 4 years, and I that was very important, actually. And not only was it a privilege and a very thrilling thing to do, but it caused me to think hard about how we communicate science and what people are interested in and how they get engaged. So since then, I've come back to University College London, and although I'm professor of climate science, I've been much more interested in, you know, how do opinions form? Why is it that people don't take notice of scientific evidence and so on?
Yeah, I found it interesting in your email that you referred to studying the psychology of climate dismissal and the communication of climate science with a whole new group of scientists and the interaction of climate science and policy. Do you want to talk about that a little and maybe give a preview to your report, Time to Change?
Yes, I'm happy to. We're just about to publish a report called Climate Science Revisited. Time for Change is the lead sort of title. Time for Change? And I guess, you know, one of the things we've concluded is that climate scientists tend to be drawn from the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, oceanography, atmospheric sciences, and so on. And by and large, they know relatively little about what social scientists and neuroscientists have learned about people's behaviors and how people come to conclusions, how they make up their minds about things and so on. And I guess the most obvious thing to realize is that climate science is very different from astrophysics or particle physics, you know, studying the origins of the universe and so on. If I give a lecture on the Higgs boson or the origins of the universe or stellar astrophysics, it taps into people's curiosity about the world around them. but it's emotionally and ideologically neutral. So it doesn't challenge people's emotions or their behaviors or their beliefs. It's just something interesting about the world around us. But if we start to tell the story of climate science and say, well, you know, we have this huge complex system, and unfortunately, mankind, through no malpractice, but simply as an unwanted side effect of our economic and population growth and our use of technology, we've now become a sufficiently big driver in the planet that we're changing the climate system upon which we rely for our food, our water. You know, all of our infrastructure has been built according to the climate system we inherited. And so what does that do? Well, it instantly raises emotions in the listener, you know, anxieties, perhaps feelings of guilt, loss, if there's no obvious solution, helplessness. That is why many people would prefer not to believe the inconvenient or unwanted truth, and are very prone to listening to other people who, for whatever reason, give them a simple alternative and say, well, you know, climate's always changed, it's the sun, it's cosmic rays, or, well, we've always adapted, there's nothing we can do about it anyway, so why don't we just adapt? And, I mean, some things you cannot adapt to. And however unlikely those suggestions might be, they give people a way out of the discomfort of their anxieties. So it seems that it's those sort of fairly straightforward principles that can explain at least part of the backlash against the climate science message.
That brings me to my second to last question. As people are getting ready for the climate change deniers piping up on the May 12 NASA press conference, Elizabeth Colbert wrote something really interesting for The New Yorker. She said that the so-called climate skeptics that always accuse scientists of alarmism and overreacting, that if you look at the reality of things, you can find the exact opposite, that a pattern of under rather yeah. than over-reporting emerges, certainly in the work of the IPCC.
I think there's quite a lot of evidence that climate scientists, are so careful. When they speak, the audience they're really speaking to is the audience of their peers, the other scientists, whose esteem they seek and whose esteem they offer. And the worst thing for a scientist is to be seen by other scientists as sort of a bit wild or irresponsible. So they're terribly cautious. And in many respects, they follow the line of least drama, it's been called. And of course, it's easy, isn't it, when one is talking about phenomena that are alarming, to turn it round and say, oh, you're being alarmist. But if in the end that simply bullies and intimidates people into not talking about it at all, then that's not very helpful to society. And I mean, if I could just say something about, I don't really like to call those that vehemently disagree that climate change is a problem, I don't like to honor them with the name skeptics, because all scientists are skeptics. You know, that's our trade. We are constantly skeptical. And that's really important, because I think a lot of people don't understand that. You know, imperfect as it may be, scientists follow the scientific method. That is, they put forward ideas. Even to get them published, they have to put them through a review of other scientists who decide whether or not the idea is flawed or has errors in it or is not justified. And sometimes good science gets wrongly stopped at that point. And sometimes bad science gets through. But that doesn't matter, because the whole point is that once it's published, it sits there and it can be considered by the rest of the community. And it's a form of organized skepticism. And over time, and sometimes it may take a long time, the stuff that's wrong gets weeded out and the stuff that's right is what's left. Now, the so-called skeptics, let's call them dismissers, don't have that process. All they offer you is opinion which has been amplified in an echo chamber of their own little group who they talk to all the time. And the day that they come forward with a process which is equivalent to the scientific process, of distilling out what is right and what is wrong, then we might take them seriously. But they cannot be taken seriously until they do that. If they abide by the process of science, then they might have something useful to say. As it is, they don't.
And my last question would be, I was so intrigued to see you working on a play. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I can. So it's a play that will, I'll perform it at the Royal Court Theatre in London, which is known worldwide for being a place where very thoughtful experimental new work is tried out. And it will be my thoughts on climate change. It's called 2071 because in 2071, my eldest grandchild will be the age that I am now. And of course, it's impossible to imagine what the world will look like in 2071. But one of the big factors that will shape what the world looks like is the sort of things that we've been talking about, you know, what the sea level rise has been in the interim, you know, how the climate has been disrupted and so on. And so I'm really interested and excited to do this because the proscenium arch and the theatrical space where people have, you know, paid for tickets to go and listen to this performance offers me an opportunity to be to play a role which is not my scientific role. So it allows me a freedom to express opinions, to express emotions, to give my thoughts in ways that I can't if I give a public lecture as a professor of climate science. If I do the latter, I have to stick by the rules of science, you know, utterly impartial, dispassionate, highly factual, and so on. Whereas a theatrical platform allows me to just be me and say, you know, let's just, you know, set the science aside for the present. I've been doing this for 40 years now, and if you want to hear what I think, this is it. So that's what this is about.
That was Professor Chris Rapley, former director of the British Antarctic Survey, and now professor of climate science at University College London. This is the last of a four-part TUC radio series that deals with the disturbing news announced at a NASA press conference in early May 2014 that a part of the West Antarctic ice sheet is melting rapidly and will contribute to a 4-foot sea level rise. So far, it is unclear how long it will take. It may be 100 years, or 200, or more, or even less. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Open the newest programs page and scroll down. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. TUC Radio's free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. You can contact TUC Radio online at tucradio.org. The email is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.